Welcome, everyone. This is The LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, September 9th, 2006. And as you know, we're live on the internet from 3 to 4 Eastern Time in the United States. And we are on LaRouchePub.com every week at this time. I'll be the host today, Marcia Mary Baker. I'm with the staff for economics for EIR News Service. And our broadcast today, where we have two guests from Washington, D.C., and here in the studio live with me, whom I'll introduce in a minute, our broadcast comes 3 days after what's really an historic international event, a webcast that occurred September 6th, based out of Berlin, where a keynote was given by Lyndon LaRouche, and people in that chamber and also in Washington, D.C., and also gathered by internet connection in places around the world, in the Americas and Asia and elsewhere, and in the Midwest especially, including in union halls and colleges and other locations. People discussed, after the keynote by LaRouche, his concepts, his vantage point of what the world should be doing and what it should look like over the next 50 years, in particular in Eurasia. And what Mr. LaRouche did was orient people's thinking to have to go outside today's existing assumptions. In other words, to go outside thinking in any terms of globalization as a fait accompli, to think outside the map that we are now facing of these, in fact, battlegrounds of World War III that amount to irregular warfare in Southwest Asia and many other parts of the world, to think outside the pessimism that's associated with our generational problem of the boomers and the 68ers, where everything seems hopeless and the end of the line. So he laid out concepts of, in fact, what's involved in making breakthroughs in both the scientific, in the economic, in the political situation. We can go ahead. I just want to say this is underscored if you look today at just the liftoff, yet again at 11:15 Eastern Time in the United States, of the new space mission. I mean, this is the kind of thing technically we could do and could have done for the last 20 years, but we've been tied down here. So the speech of Mr. LaRouche and all of the dialogue that took place on this particular occasion is going to be released in the next 48 to 70 hours in hard copy for mass circulation here in the United States as a mass circulation pamphlet by the Lyndon LaRouche Political Action Committee, LaRouche PAC. And resources are needed for that. I just want to tell people it is going to happen, but resources are needed to make it happen. And the latest is that sometime at the end of October, the beginning of November, the dialogue's going to be continued. Mr. LaRouche again will meet with people based in Berlin, and more people are already expected and lining up to continue this dialogue because of the urgent world crisis situation, especially people from Russia, China, India. And so we really have a process initiated that's why I said it's historic. It is underway, and it's literally can be the way to change the policy direction of what otherwise seems on an hour-by-hour basis a complete mess here in Washington and elsewhere. So that leads me to introduce our guests, because we have with the LaRouche Youth Movement implementing and enforcing the kind of thinking that I just described of Mr. LaRouche, of what can be done in the world. We have seen in the last week during which this special September 6th event occurred of LaRouche's webcast, we've seen a week of action by the LaRouche Youth Movement in Washington, D.C., welcoming Congress back for its short session, where we really need overnight change and courage on the part of people. So to give a firsthand report, we welcome Miles Robinson. Hi, Miles.
Hi, Marcia.
And you're speaking from where, you can tell people?
I'm in Washington, D.C. right now.
And it's the LaRouche Youth Movement office, and he's been in the thick of things, not just this week, he is usually, but especially this week. But, and with me today in the studio for the LaRouche Show, we welcome Tony Papert.
Hi.
And I just want to say that Tony, in fact, he just left a meeting. He's been involved in task force meetings, I think, the last 76 hours, almost nonstop. We've taken away from his computer because he's writing this up. He is involved in a task force that's getting to the bottom of the scope, the nature of enemy operations against what we just described happening, having a policy shift in the world towards serving mankind. Namely, we've given attention on the show, and you know the attention that LaRouche Pack and Mr. LaRouche has given to the Synergy, this grouping of financial syndicates of figures and banks and what they call Fondi in the old terminology of private interests who are against nation states, against the common good of people, populations, and in particular, some really rotten, dirty cultural warfare, dirty tricks operations have been going on, and that's why this task force that Tony Papert's been on has been involved. In other words, who are these people? What are they doing to subvert Mr. LaRouche, subvert people of goodwill around the world who are carrying things or who are doing things? And what I'm going to do is just open up for Tony with this question. I understand that in the next 10 days to a couple weeks, Tony, EIR is going to be online and in its print media getting out a dossier with photographs, profiles, flowcharts of these no-goodniks. And you, I know today, I said we just took you away from your writing, are doing a summary, a kind of preview of who's up to what. So start anywhere you like. What's this capability? Who's the worst guy? Whatever you want to do to kick it off.
Well, the way it's coming to light is the corruption of public television. And that's very much connected, even though this fraudulent drama, which ABC, Disney intend to show tomorrow night, Sunday night, called The Path to 9/11, is not public television, it's private television. But that's closely related with the story we've been putting together of the corruption of American public television over the past 10 years, roughly. The 10 to 15 years. The place it all came together was as exposed by Ken Auletta in New Yorker magazine in 2004. In early 2003, the president of the public broadcasting system, which is an important part of the public television, also public radio apparatus in the U.S., supported by taxpayer dollars, she had set up, after 8 years, or really even more, almost 20 years, of campaigns to force public television to either shut down or be taken over by neocons. In early 2003, Pat Mitchell accepted an invitation to tea at the Naval Observatory from Lynn Cheney, wife of the vice president, who's far more important than her husband. And her husband is a kind of thug with limited mentality, but Lynn Cheney is the one who has the connections to Baroness Simmons in Britain, to Tony Blair, and to other top people, especially in Britain. So Pat Mitchell accepted an invitation to tea, and in the Naval Observatory, Lynn Cheney's residence, with her, she found a man named Michael Pack, a little-known name to the public right now. And this Michael Pack had come with a scheme for a series of weekly, hour-long public television shows hosted by Lynn Cheney. What the title was supposed to be, I don't know. And, of course, given this unrelenting campaign that public TV would either embrace the neocons, fire liberals, or be shut down for lack of funds, Pat Mitchell took this proposal seriously, even though no elected official or wife of an elected official had ever hosted a serial television show on public television for good reasons. But who now? This, of course, it didn't happen. This Lynn Cheney hour is not being shown, although tomorrow's Disney documentary will be a good substitute if Disney is allowed to get away with showing it, which they won't necessarily be. It was dropped largely because this Michael Pack, about whom I'm going to say more, again, a name not well known to the public, Michael Pack, within a matter of weeks, was taken from, he had no public office, except that he was a member of the National Endowment for Humanities. Again, the taxpayer-funded program for funding the arts, which Lynn Cheney had been the head of and left when her husband was became vice president. So Pack was a member of the National Endowment for Humanities. He had no other public office. He had this proposal for a series of programs hosted by Lynn Cheney. It was dropped because within weeks after the meeting, or it wasn't necessarily dropped, but it was put on ice and hasn't happened, because within weeks after the meeting, this Michael Pack was named head of television for the Corporation of Public Broadcasting, meaning he was head of all publicly supported television in the United States, which he was from 2003, early 2003, when he was appointed until he quit in early 2006. Now, who is Michael Pack? There's a lot in his history which is inaccessible to the public, but what is on the public record is that since the late 1980s, what he's been doing is producing lying, fraudulent documentaries. All these lies are done under the cover of being documentaries. None of them are called fiction, which is what they actually are. He's been making documentary after documentary for public television in the interests of neoconservatives who have been paying him to do this, paying him to put their lies on publicly supported television. A telling example, though it's atypical, is that in summer 98, Michael Pack was making a film on the police beating of Rodney King in Los Angeles, which was then a headline matter. Again, he was making a documentary for public television, but the newsletter, the summer 1998 newsletter of the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund, was devoted entirely to an appeal for funds for Michael Pack to make this movie, to show the other side, although the movie didn't say it was showing the other side, to show the other side of the Rodney King beating, i.e. the police officers who had beaten him. The newsletter ended by saying, "We're not finished paying for the production costs of the Rodney King incident," which is Pack's movie. "So we'd appreciate any donations you're able to send. These contributions of at least $50 will receive a videotape of the film. A reply envelope is enclosed." But most of the great part of Pack's money, and the money is far greater amounts than one would think are justified by these public TV documentaries, which all have a very low budget look to them. By far the greatest part of his money, from $20,000 to $75,000 and more per year, comes from the private foundation of a New York banker named John Train, about 80 years of age. Train himself is a millionaire, but it's actually not his money. He's passing through tens of thousands and multi-tens of thousands of dollars of contributions, which he gets from other foundations, including the Olin and Bradley Foundations, very prominently, which paid for the whole conservative revolution, AEI Heritage Foundation, the Ford Foundation, also the Bodman Foundation, which has had a peculiar role in operations against Lyndon LaRouche. Bodman Foundation is the funder of the American Family Foundation, which is a big anti-LaRouche witch hunt organization, formerly ran an outfit called Cult Awareness Network, which it had to rename because it lost a huge legal suit. Michael Pack. I mean, he did one fraud after another.
Can I just put? Let me interject, and
sure.
We should get, because this is like the red dye going through it all. You have, as you say, you got this path to 9/11. And people will know, most listening in or might listen later, that John Train, that's the equivalent of saying the Get LaRouche Task Force, which at a critical time, I'm sure you were getting to this, but just to interject and then come back, when of a policy intervention by Mr. LaRouche over 1982 and 1983 that strategically the world could have through defense weapons called beam weapons, a strategic defense against any of the nuclear terror or hostage any threats of nuclear warfare in the world. And this was announced then by President Reagan in March 1983. And John Train had a sell-on how to get LaRouche and started his operations in April 1983. Here you go, as you mentioned.
Just 1 month afterwards. Yeah. PAC's and Train's involvement of ex-labor committees in this operation is the incriminating evidence. As I said, PAC became head of all television programming for the public, for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting in early 2003, held that position for 3 years. In that position, he was giving out the money to make TV documentaries of the type which he himself had been making all the years before. And what he paid for was he paid for Richard Pearl to make The Case for War in a documentary. He paid for neocon Robert Kaplan inside the American Empire. He paid for Frank Gaffney to make a documentary against Islamic extremists. He paid for the entire salon, the entire pig pen of neocon crazies to make so-called documentaries for public television. He also paid ex-LaRouche associates Dan Polin and Ken Mandel to produce a documentary on the trial of Saddam Hussein, for which they were given exclusive access to the trial. Now, it turns out that he had been involving these ex-Labor Committee associates in his projects for some time. He had had a long-time association with Polin, probably dating back to 1977, again, paid for by John Train. He had then infiltrated Polin into the Labor Committees sometime by 1980 or thereabouts. Then Polin had a guy, a then Labor Committee member, join him, Ken Mandel, in 1986, informing another of these fraudulent documentation production companies called Great Projects Productions. And then these two made the trial of Saddam Hussein. They made a series on American political parties jointly with PAC himself. They shared in the Train largesse and then in the taxpayer dollars largesse when Michael PAC was able to pay them out of the public trough as head of television for Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So, yes, that is really the red dye. The use of these ex-Labor Committee members traces it back to just what you said, the John Train operation against the SDI. I mean, as Marcia said, from the time of his presidential campaign of 1976, LaRouche had seen that the world was trapped in the no exit of what was called mutually assured destruction, that we can no longer, this is, of course, back in the late Cold War days, that we can have no, there is no defense, so the thing went, against thermonuclear weapons. All we can do is annihilate those who can annihilate us. And the world was trapped in this no exit situation. And LaRouche worked with scientists who showed the feasibility of an actual defense against thermonuclear weapons through electromagnetic beam weapons like lasers. In the course of the 1980 campaign, when he was again a candidate, LaRouche personally met Ronald Reagan at a campaign event. When Reagan took office, people from Reagan's staff were assigned to work with LaRouche on what projects they might find of mutual interest. And what was agreed was that in conjunction with the Reagan National Security Council, LaRouche would hold a series of secret discussions with a leading Soviet representative on his proposal, LaRouche's proposal, for a mutual defense against thermonuclear weapons of annihilation, i.e. thermonuclear missiles, which Reagan supported, because for all of the other weaknesses he had, he had always opposed what he called revenge weapons, mutual annihilation, He always opposed Henry Kissinger in his outlook also for similar reasons. So Reagan tended to agree, followed with interest LaRouche's negotiations with the Soviets on this. And then, as Marcia said, in March of 1983,
March 23rd, 1983, we can broadcast it again next week.
In a half-hour show, and the last five-minute segment, there were like about three different segments on different policy areas, but the last of the three segments was devoted to the concept which to the LaRouche's concept, which Reagan proposed to the Soviets on TV in exactly the same terms as he knew LaRouche had proposed to them, to which Reagan gave the name of SDI. So this, although it was rejected by the Soviets, flatly rejected by new Soviet General Secretary Andropov, it had been, the U.S. government had been won over to this plan of LaRouche's. And then it was then apparently right on that day, March 23rd, 83, John Train went to work. And within a month, almost exactly a month later, he had a meeting of tens of leading media representatives in his apartment in New York, in his house in New York, for the purpose of cooking up criminal charges against LaRouche through the media in order to prepare the way for a frame-up. And eventually that happened. The frame-up took place. LaRouche was sent to jail for 5 years under fraudulent charges, sentenced to 15 years and served 5 years under fraudulent charges. It was Train who put this together, and it's Train who funded the takeover of public television by the neoconservatives as part of this overall anti-LaRouche, anti-SDI operation, beginning roughly March 23rd, 1983, or perhaps a little earlier.
And it just strikes me, and Miles, in a minute, you can certainly ask anything to clarify or to bring out any points here. But throughout this, the one feature is it's not just plain old dirty, filthy operations, but to go to defectors, to run this kind of kidnapping operations. The American Family Foundation, you know, you look at the funding that's involved in this.
Cult Awareness Network.
Cult Awareness Network.
Whose so-called deprogrammers were convicted for kidnapping.
Right. That this is, you see the character of this years-long operations and involves, you mentioned some of the political figures who then get the movie treatment, Richard Pearl. One of them is Michael Ledeen. And I know Miles wants to say something about running into him personally this week.
Oh, really? Great.
Yeah, but maybe you could point out his connection. I mean, he's part of the apparatus, right?
Yes, of course he is. And they're closely connected. But the thing which has just come to light, when I said Train funded all this dirty stuff, what he funded it through was a private foundation of which he's the head, which is called Northcote Parkinson Foundation. Northcote Parkinson Foundation gets money principally from a wide variety of other foundations. But one of its contributors is a company, I believe the name is SI, which the company consists solely of Michael Ledeen and his wife Barbara. Oh. So the two of them are apparently, you know, breaking their piggy bank to contribute to the dirty operations of John Train through Northcote Parkinson, which he totally controls.
Yeah, Tony, I got one question going through all this, because it seems like there's all these foundations set up and there's this very rigid network of organizations that is set up to channel certain funds. But, I mean, where is the money starting from? I mean, who is it that has the original intention to sick someone like John Train and these cronies in public television to really slander history
these individuals and the money they dispose are not always the same thing. Remember, the largest of the endowed foundations is the Ford Foundation, but it was, I believe, during the 1960s, if I'm not wrong, that the Ford Foundation was forced to publicly sever all relations with the Ford family, to publicly sever all relations with the foundation because they disagreed with what it's doing. And then Train has this Northcote Parkinson. It's minute as a foundation. It has an endowment of $250,000, which is practically nothing. But he gives out a lot of money by virtue of getting other contributions to him. But so the business of squirreling away these hoards of money and protecting them from taxation is imitation of what's called the European Fondi system, which is exactly the way the ruling oligarchic, especially black nobility families in Europe, fund themselves. But in effect, I mean, the evil principle of the fondo or the fondi, which are just like our foundations, it's the same word, even outlives the families which are connected. I mean, frequently the family is considered not evil enough for the fondo, and the family is replaced by another family which will do the evil. What Train represents, and his family has back to the 18th century, what Train represents is the American Tory wing of especially the American Tory wing of Wall Street, what Roosevelt called the American Tories and also the American Royalists. Train's family, a large part of his own fortune, originates in a clipper ship company, which his family set up to participate in the British opium trade with India. Remember, the British, I mean, every people know the history. I mean, the British fought wars with the government, two wars with the imperial government of China to force them to accept opium coming into the country freely, i.e. free trade arrangements like NAFTA and so on. To force them to accept opium coming into the country freely, even though it was against their law. The opium was grown in India, and this was the money-making business. When the British got out of the slave trade, they went into the opium trade. And a number, unfortunately, of our Tory American families, especially from New England, joined. Others did not, but a number of our Tory American families joined in this new slave trade, the dope trade, the opium trade. Train's family was one of them. That's where the money comes from. He's represented that point of view ever since. He's the dirtiest wing of what has been called in the past the banker's CIA, or what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex. He's there to do things, which from their dirtiness, from their ill repute, nobody else would do, as in this case.
So, or another expression, I guess, the Perkins book that people have paid attention to. He's the hitman for the economic hitman of the world.
Economic hitman, exactly.
One thing is, let me just mention we're coming on to the halftime break, and I'll make an announcement and then pick up on this train of thought again. But this is the LaRue Show. It's September 9th, 2006, and we are weekly from 3 to 4 in the afternoon Eastern Time on www.larouchepub.com, LaRouchePub.com. We invite your emails anytime or during the show at radio@larouchepub.com. And I especially encourage everyone to look at LaRouche Pub. You can also look on LaRouche Pack. .com, the Political Action Committee of Lyndon LaRouche, for the text of his keynote from September 6th from an international webcast that was centered in Berlin and Washington, D.C. simultaneously. And you can find that text there, and soon that plus much of the dialogue, the questioning back and forth, is going to be published in a mass circulation item. And you could make a point of getting it and contributing to circulate it. So let me just get back to this. I know there was a pun on getting to the train of thought, but that's being too polite. But one thing, back to take up Miles' question about who originates this, where is it all starting from? Miles, you'll recognize in this swarm of foundations that contribute money. Then it goes into a key capability like this thing called the Northcote Parkinson Foundation. I think that was named after, there was a Sir Northcote Parkinson. Tony can say more. I think he was one of these guys that believed in regional, tribal, didn't believe in nation states. Is that right?
Yeah, yes. I mean, in any case, he's a deceased British historian. He's widely praised by those people. I don't know much about him firsthand, but he is praised by those people who advocate the splitting of North America, which, of course, was the purpose of the Civil War from the British point of view. He's praised by those who advocate splitting North America into many more small countries rather than having a big United States.
Right, we can have Arcadia and we can have this and that.
So these people who openly advocate that are ones who fall all over themselves to praise Northcote Parkinson.
Anyway, Tony and Miles, I understand the board of directors of this thing that naturally has on John Train and some other characters. One of the characters is a fellow who helped found years ago the French American Foundation, and guess who's on its board? Felix Rohatyn, along with John Train. So that gives an idea of money flows and who's who, right?
Absolutely. Can I add one other thing, just because there is a close connection. I didn't say what it is. But there is a close connection between this pattern of corruption of public television by John Train and the lying fraud which ABC Disney intends to show tomorrow night, which says that Clinton and his administration were responsible for September 11, 2001. David Horowitz, far right-wing activist, is very much closely allied with both of them in the same capacity. David Horowitz formed in the 90s, if I'm correct, it was in or perhaps before the 90s, he formed the Committee for Media Integrity. The purpose of that committee was what I described earlier, to enforce that public television would either become a mouthpiece for the neoconservatives or would be shut down. And it's a measure of the success of what he did that by 2003, one of the leading officials in public television was going to Lynn Cheney to discuss herself taking to the air in taxpayer-supported public television. The other thing he did was similarly fund fund a movement for Hollywood to say that Hollywood had liberal bias and Hollywood must become a mouthpiece for the neocons, okay? So he has a nest of people in Hollywood, and his nest of people in Hollywood, for instance, he took over the Liberty Film Festival. And his nest of people, of neocons in Hollywood, are part of the ABC Disney documentary, which they intend to try to show tomorrow night.
And then I understand that in line with all this, there was the Committee for Campus Integrity and something called Campus Watch. And this was directly Lynn Cheney and Joe Lieberman headed up the campus side to kind of...
And David Horowitz. I mean, this is the outfit which tries to fire any professors who are not neocons. And particularly, their biggest... thing, at least in the public print, is professors who are Arabs and who don't agree with the Israeli cause the way these people conceive it, which is usually much worse than any current government of Israel, that these people must be fired. They're extremely active. They just prevented Juan Cole, for instance, is a Michigan professor. He was offered a job by Yale. And this group, formed by Lynn Cheney, Horowitz, Joe Lieberman, went to the Yale, not only trustees, but to the Yale contributors, the Yale funders, to prevent the appointment of Cole, and they succeeded in preventing it.
And then, of course, you have, this is the whole network for spotters, trappers, stalkers of the LaRouche Youth Movement.
Yeah. Which I think the LaRouche Youth Movement members on the phone probably have had contact with it.
Yeah, there's a member who actually did have direct contact with somebody from that. His father arranged for a meeting, and I forget exactly who it was from the American Family Foundation. But nonetheless, I mean, this person was taken into the woods and highly solicited, and you know, he said that the tactics that were used on him, it was incredibly scary and incredibly, I mean, you could see through it. You could really see through what this guy's intention was. And, but nonetheless, I mean, the member was not at all put off by this. In fact, he did a little more work into the circles around exactly what his father had hired, and you know, discovered that these are the same people that, like you were saying, Tony, go back to the Get LaRouche campaign, the people that organized for the exactly. the bankruptcy of our organizations.
Yeah.
Jailings, bankruptcy. So that's the nature of what the capability is then. Miles, we have time to discuss any particulars of this, but in Washington, you were there. Could you describe the scene as Congress opened? Because
after the webcast.
After the, well, they opened the same week as this webcast, yeah. Because you were there with something like a 250,000 leaflets on the streets and everywhere else in terms of countering the big lie that Rumsfeld tried to say, that it was, well, you can describe the situation.
Yeah, I mean, this was just absurd. You had Donald Rumsfeld coming out saying that Democratic congressmen and senators who were opposed to, or rather opposed to this hardline neocon policy on the war on terror, were not only capitulating to terrorism, but akin to Nazi appeasers. Right. So this is just an absolutely insane and outlandish comment. And what LaRouche did to expose this was he said, look, you know, you're talking about a family who, the Bushes, that is, a family who going back two generations only was directly involved in funding apparatuses to the Nazi Party. And, you know, now you have a war that's being started with that same intention. And the people who are opposed to that are now being branded as Nazis. It's completely absurd. And so LaRouche put out this leaflet, which, along with an advertisement of his webcast, went through the history, very briefly, of the Bush family and certain Nazi funding apparatuses around the bank of Brown Brothers and Harriman, et cetera, out of New York, and then the conduits in London, et cetera, that were taking this money and putting it into the Nazi Party to fulfill the intention that was later became World War II. And so we got this thing out probably yesterday. We got about 30,000 out alone. Over the course of the week, we got well over 100,000 out. And the effect that this thing had, not only the response that we had at the webcast from institutional contacts, I mean, not just in D.C., but all over the world, but you also had, and this not necessarily just because of the leaflet, but because of the work that we've been doing on the road in question, the work that we did in New York City throughout the month of August, hitting New York City at two different occasions. One before Rowan fled into the veil of Lehman Brothers away from his own name, and one immediately after that, both of which pointing out exactly what this guy's been into, similar Nazi connections with the Rowan character as well as with Bush. And the Congress, when we went in there on Tuesday, the day before Lynn's webcast from Berlin, had really, really shifted. And I've been organizing in Washington for about 6 months, and I haven't been in the Congress for the month of August. And I went back into this place, and usually, you know, the time that it takes me to go through the offices on the offices that I usually go to took me a lot longer. I mean, the time that I spent in each office was filled with people from the back of the office, high-level staff people coming out, asking questions. One real singularity, an office that had never really given us the time of day, you know, you had the LD come out on his lunch break just looking for a fight, just looking for, because they get the sense that business-as-usual politics is not the way that this situation is going to get fixed. Unfortunately, this is what they've been hoping for a very long time, that they can just continue squeaking by, telling lies and having these really inane town meetings with constituents where nothing really gets said, that this is not working. And the reality of the situation, especially after the month of August, now that they've actually reacquainted themselves with the reality that their constituents is facing, they're realizing that a change in axioms and a real shift in the way that they are thinking about policy and the way that we're thinking about policy is completely necessary. So the potential right now in the U.S. Congress to open up to something more sane is not only is happening, but it's completely lawful. It should have happened months and months ago, but, you know, the reason why is because of this Roten question, and we've gone through that on previous shows ad nauseum. But I think one of the more significant things that we did here this week was centered around the visit of the former
president
of Iran, this guy, Mohammad Khatami. Is that right?
Yep.
Yes. Why don't you go into that, please?
Well, it was funny because I had gone to a press conference at the National Press Club. I believe it was Thursday morning. And it was advertised as just being a press conference on the arrival of the Iranian president, sponsored by the National Institute for Democracy in Iran or something like this. And so I thought it was just going to be some rundown of his schedule or go through what he was planning on speaking about. And I thought it was very uneventful. And, you know, I kind of went a little bit begrudgingly. But I get there, and the National Press Club is filled with all of these people with Iranian pins on. So I thought, oh, you know, this would be a very, you know, good opportunity to meet some people and make some contacts. So we go into me and my friend, we go into the press room and talk to some other members of the press. All of a sudden, the room just gets really, really busy. And then you had about 25 people from Iran walk on the stage or walk into the room in the press briefing holding these signs, these Falun Gong-style real propaganda signs with images of people getting their, you know, heads chopped off, people getting beaten, people missing limbs, etc. And it was immediately addressed by a man from this Democracy Institute for Iran, a guy named Reza Pahlavi. And Pahlavi took about 10 minutes to address the audience on the insanity of the Khatami regime, the insanity of the Ahmadinejad regime, and the necessity for regime change. So then you had one of the women who was up there holding one of these signs give her personal account. And then attending this incredibly insane propaganda rally was a senator from Kansas, Sam Brownback, and a congressman from California, a guy named Brad Sherman. Now, the Democrat, this was more surprising because Brownback historically has been a mouthpiece for the neocon agenda to start this endless warfare in the Middle East. So his intention to spread this to Iran and to pipe up this regime change, et cetera, was pretty forecastable. But this Democrat, Sherman, who's on, I believe, the Foreign Relations Committee or the Foreign Policy Committee in the House, he's, I think, the ranking Dem on it, he gave an address where he said that the United States, by funding the trip of the former Iranian president around the country, by providing him with security and by giving him the same treatment that we would give any other normal foreign diplomat, was U.S. tax dollars going towards the funding of Iranian terrorism.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you had all of these people, most of which spoke only Farsi, who were sitting there giving these highly emotional personal accounts of, well, essentially the necessity for regime change.
Yeah, right.
And so, I mean, this is somewhat, you know, it really struck me as being really, really crazy that this is going on at the same time you had a lull in the ability for this administration to spark war with Iran.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
And after a month where it seemed like the war of choice shifted from Iran to what we experienced in Lebanon.
Right.
So then we went to the Khatami event later that evening.
National Cathedral.
All of these people were there.
And this is the, people can visualize the National Cathedral as a major event in the evening.
Yeah, right. And there was 200 people who were just shouting, these enraged, most of which were Iranians, but you did have some totally brainwashed Americans toting these signs about Islamofascism and, you know, screaming at the top of their lungs. But at the same time, across the street, this is what you had, but lined up outside of the cathedral were some of the people who were on the list to get in. And so we distributed all of Mr. LaRouche's literature to these people, and we set up a chorus where we performed, among other things, Bach's Jesu meine Freude.
65-person chorus? What was it? That's how large was it?
Well, we probably had about 35 to 40 people singing.
Right, right.
Bach would be pleased.
The rest of us were organizing. Yeah, and we've done a lot of work on this canon, I mean on this motet, and we've really understood or are beginning to understand certain key ways in order to get across Bach's intention. And what this enables us to do is very, very quickly get somebody thinking about what a human being is,
right.
Somewhat silently, right? So we can go up and approach them about more concrete matters like how to deal with the situation, the crisis in Iran. And they have a much softer approach to this. They're not blinded by certain axioms that they are normally using or assumptions that they've somewhat arbitrarily assumed about the situation. And you can start talking to them on a much more human level.
Right.
And this was the case, and it really had a massive effect. We made a lot of contacts, and I saw there at the rally a lot of these same crazy Falun Gong Zionist types,
right,
who were, you know, essentially toting the same Jabotinsky line that we've got to murder all of these radical Islams,
right.
Islamic people. A lot of these people were Christians, and they were saying at this meeting that the Islamic religion has built within it the kind of evil that Ahmadinejad and Khatami are being accused of saying. So it just represents a very unrigorous approach to this, obviously. Now, we did run into Michael Ledeen there, a fellow organizer of mine, approached him and said, "Hey, are you Michael Ledeen?" He says, "Yes, I am." And he was very kind of enraged because he was surrounded by this environment. And he says, "Well, I read in EIR magazine that you wrote a book called Universal Fascism and vehemently detest the nation state, the idea of the nation state," something like this. He said, "Is that true?" He says, you know, the guy's kind of squirming. He says, no, it's not true. He goes, "Oh, so you like the nation state? You agree with it in principle?" So, I mean, he, you know, said, "Yes, I think it's a fine institution," or something, and waltzed off, obviously.
That's funny.
Contrary to everything that he's ever written or put out.
I didn't know that. That's really
to,
funny.
To get out of a bind with a member of the limb.
Terrific.
He touted FDR and ran away. So this represents, I think, something that's pretty indicative globally right now, that the
yes.
situation is on the edge. And
what you were able to do also.
Yeah, right. I mean, either people are going to go insane or they're going to find beauty.
Yeah.
And they're going to understand humanity.
Yeah.
And that contrast was there very, very vividly.
Yeah. Yeah,
right.
I heard that too.
Well, one of the, just what you're saying, talking about being the truth squad in the most beautiful way for the world. I have two questions, but one for you, Miles. What about since you got out these 100,000 leaflets, what tended to be the response to people who probably did know that Rumsfeld was making these charges, and then that what you were telling them, that, you know, LaRouche correcting them on history? Did people respond to that? Did they?
Yeah. I mean, as somewhat of an anecdote, yeah, what we found most vividly, though, was the recognition that Lin's ideas are far from just being valid, but they're what needs to be implemented right now. And you can use the flight forward insanity of the Bush administration right now as evidenced as to, you know, ironically, how it seems like the Bush administration is trying to prove Lin right.
Yes, exactly.
Because this whole time he's been saying that these people are absolutely losing it. And, you know, the history of this family is obviously documented, but by completely ignoring this and calling the Democratic Party Nazis,
exactly. It's...
I mean, it's just absurd. And anybody who's sane and not looking to get some kickback for their political campaign from this grouping of people is going to realize that. And I think because of the political power of the youth movement and because of the quality of the EIR that we're getting out en masse in D.C., people are really starting to recognize not only the validity of Lynn, but the necessity of his policies.
And but I just want to tell everyone, too, the this history that you just mentioned about the generations of the Bush family involvement in literally the networks bringing about the Hitler and so forth, this is going to be an EIR online, and it's going to be in the next print EIR that comes out. It's a chapter taken from the unauthorized biography of Bush. Tony Chaitkin, who was a co-author of that, is that will be in the next issue of EIR, and so people should make a point of that. And Miles, you may have something else, but I just wanted to ask Tony if there's one aspect of all these rotten capabilities in and around John Train over the last decades that has to do with the role of mobilized youth in the world, that apparently there was some outfit set up in 1960 or 1959 called Youth YWAM, Youth with a Mission, that was literally part of this kind
of... Yeah, it's just, this is now reverberating around the internet.
Okay.
This phony fraud show that ABC Disney intend to present tomorrow, and again, they've got to be prevented from doing so. The screenwriter is named Norasta. He's from Iranian origin, born in the U.S., very young. The director is named David Cunningham. It turns out that David Cunningham is the son of the two founders of a worldwide cult whose name is usually pronounced YWAM, Youth with a Mission, which was formed in 1959, some say 1960, but has worldwide reach, clearly a large number of members and cities, and it seems offices in hundreds of cities, headquarters in Hawaii, which was where David Cunningham was born. He had only two previous movies, both the writer and director extremely young, and especially this director, relatively inexperienced. Only two apparently previous movies come to market. One was a Hawaii tourist type of movie where he was from. I mean, it had a love plot, but basically seems to have been an excuse for touristy footage. The other called An End to War, if I have that right. Now, An End to War had a fictional plot in a Japanese prison camp during World War II. I could say more about it. But the Fundy Press, so-called evangelical, so-called Christian press, reviewed it saying, this is a Christian movie. It may not seem like it because it has an R rating, it has sex, nudity, and you name it. But it's really a Christian movie. And they interviewed Cunningham, the director, who said, yes, the people who make Christian movies with PG ratings are really flaying from the issue. You know, I make these Christian movies, you can't tell they're Christian, but they have more influence that way. And
yes, how you spell Christ, XXXX.
So he is the director, and it turns out actually that the notion, he learned his filmography or whatever you study to make movies, he learned it at the cult's university's film school, as did many others. And that cult university had a web page since taken down, which said, we're going to infiltrate Hollywood, and by taking control of the movies in the same way, you know, the R-rated sex, violence, nudity Christian movie, we're going to make everybody Christians without their knowing it. In effect, those weren't the words. So it turns out that this project, as far as is known, this project was dreamed up at a project of the film school of that cult. And he's not the only one in there. There's a whole lot of others. So, I mean, this, you can bet that this stuff is heavily political. It doesn't stem from the Old Testament or the New Testament or Galilee or any place like that, but from highly political circles in Washington who make use of these cults, like the National Prayer Breakfasts, the Moral Rearmament, which is now defunct, and similar cults, which were used as dirty tricks operations by a Washington faction.
Well, I think, you know, we have a few minutes left. I just want to reiterate one thing I said at the beginning. You see why these kinds of capabilities, this filthy, dirty tricks and mind control on national and international scales, these kinds of capabilities, I said, we're going to put out a dossier that will have to have flow charts, photographs, profiles, because it's not that it's so powerful against truth and against beauty, as was just described, that took place in front of the National Cathedral when Jesu Meine Freude was sung by young people. It's not that this stuff is powerful, but it's so extensive that we can get out the disinfectant and the brooms, and it probably can be swept away. And so that's why we're getting it out. And in that sense, Tony may want to add something, but Miles, you mentioned two ideas twice, and in the remaining minutes, or one idea twice. In the remaining minutes, could you address again what you're talking about when you're organizing people, whether legislative directors of congressional offices or youth and campuses or on the streets? You said people can start to grasp that LaRouche's ideas are valid, but we have to make them see that it's necessary to implement these policies. What is that what you're meaning?
Well, yeah, I mean, and I start to see it happening. I mean, the effect of what we've done in D.C. is, you know, I've been away from the town for a month. You come back after a month and you see what had fermented, and it's really something that strikes you as a singularity, because the willingness that Congress has right now to argue about reality, to fight over reality with the youth movement, is something that wasn't there 6 months ago. You see the same thing in the streets. People from all across the political boards, the ones that are leaning a little more to the saner side, are just jumping to give us their contact info, especially from places around the world. But you have inside D.C. a more growing shift towards people realizing that Lynn's approach is not Lynn's approach as such. It's not LaRouche as a political economist, and I'm therefore, becoming a LaRouche-y if I start proposing that these policies be introduced. But rather, people realize that LaRouche's policies are the ones that are going to get the United States out of this crisis. And that it's LaRouche's policies, in the tradition of people like Roosevelt, in the tradition of people like Hamilton, have uniquely been put forward by Lynn, but are historically, and this is the beauty of Lynn's writing, because he always situates you very deeply in the historical reality of the ideas that he's presenting. But people realize the historical validity of what he's putting forward. So you can either go with British imperialism and continue to destroy the financial system, which seems like the intention of the people who are behind Roatan, the people who are behind John Train. Or you can go with a nation-state system of real economic growth. And this is something that he hit on at his webcast in a really, really beautiful and polemical way, right, saying that European, and especially German, machine tooling needs to become the most vital part of a European economy. And that if Europe, and if Germany in particular, is not taking advantage of what they could do for humanity by increasing their machine tool capability, then they're not doing the maximum that they could be. And so the insanity of the policies that have given Germany's economy, such a terrible, terrible future is represented, I think, in a lot of these operations against Lynn. And the fact that now you have more and more people in D.C. looking towards him as being right is incredibly significant.
Yeah.
I mean, one other thing that I kind of wanted to bring up was that you have, with this ABC production of this movie that's attacking Clinton, something I think very significant, because you're in the midst of a financial system collapse, and the only person since Reagan to put forward a policy in the spirit of the American system, at least, I mean, you mentioned the SDI, but it was Clinton who had said through circles around him that we need a new financial system in 1998.
Right.
And I think it's very significant that as this situation is collapsing,
right,
that this...
Yes,
this
well said. They want to get him out of the way.
Yeah,
so
right.
He's not around to help that help revive that idea now.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. In new financial architecture, he made the speech in New York. So once again, we're looking at on the historic scale. This is a question of truth. And we have run out of time. Let me give the toll-free number if you want to call the Ruche Pack and make sure you can contribute or get the material. It's 1-800-929-7566. That's 1-800-929-7566. And be sure and listen next week. That will be September 16th, the same time, 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time in the United States. And I want to thank Tony Paperton and Miles Robinson. And stay tuned. It's going to be very hot. And thank you all.